Ukraine strives to hold its lines in the Donbass. Quebec wants its people to speak even more French than they already do. And when does mistrust in a particular government become distrust of the entire state? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Marie Leconte and James Rogers will discuss all the day's big stories. Plus, we'll have Henry Rhys Sheridan's latest letter from New York City and an interview with IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by the political journalist and author Marie Leconte and by James Rogers, Associate Professor of International Journalism at City University of London. Hello to you both.
Hello, Andrew.
Hi.
James, you have been swanning about lately, I believe. This is exciting. People are going places again.
I'm very excited, Andrew. Last month, I went to four countries. I went to Germany,
to France. Okay, now you're just showing off.
I went to Denmark, and then I spent 2 weeks in the United States, and it's the first time I'd been there for about 20 years, actually. So it was really, really interesting to be there. And it's going to be a big political story later this year with the midterms, albeit that I was talking to quite a narrow stratum of society, of journalists and academics. There was a big expectation that Mr. Trump isn't quite finished yet.
Well, we've got that to look forward to. Marie, can you compete with, like, however many countries it is James has been to in the last however long it was?
Well, I mean, I did just spend 2 months somewhere else, but it was a city of 50,000 people, which I did not leave, by the way. So I was in the Venetian Lagoon for 2 months straight. I did not see terra firma for over 8 weeks.
Not literally, hopefully, in the Venetian Lagoon. That would get damp.
No, to my genuine surprise, I did not fall in once. I really thought I would. I know myself. And no.
Yeah, I once spent a weekend in Venice and was quietly impressed with myself for not stumbling into the drink, although there was one of those things where quite a lot of the canal did come into where I was staying, so I didn't really have to go out and look for it.
Oh, that's nice of them.
I thought so. Anyway, we will start today in Ukraine, where Russia appears to have renewed its offensive in the eastern reaches of the country. Russia appears to be making advances on a number of fronts, with even Ukrainian officials and officers admitting that their forces in the Donbass are increasingly outgunned on land and in the air. On the diplomatic front, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has told the World Economic Forum that Russia cannot be allowed to win in Ukraine, and that he believes that President Vladimir Putin thereof will not negotiate seriously until or unless he understands that he has lost. James, first of all, as far as we can tell from this distance, does it look like Russia is beginning to turn the tide, at least as Russia would see it?
It does look that way, yes. And I think, despite the way that Ukraine's army, the way that its political system resisted this onslaught, this invasion, with much greater fortitude than many people would have expected when it first unfolded, I think there's a note of rather grim reality dawning here, in the sense that, as you say, even Ukrainian officials and Ukrainian officers are accepting that this is the situation. The fact is that Russia is a much larger army, and even if they have not prosecuted this war particularly efficiently, and it has not gone according to plan, I think we can say that without any doubt at all, it is nevertheless going in their direction, certainly in this part of the country, albeit far more slowly than was foreseen. And I think, you know, as we see this plea yesterday from the Ukrainian foreign minister for more heavy weapons, this is really the reality that Ukraine is facing. It is facing, as you say, a much bigger and more powerful army.
Marie, what to make then of Chancellor Scholz's attempt to bring, I think, an amount of pragmatic reality to bear on this? Germany has been criticised quite widely and not unreasonably for not being quite as firmly behind Ukraine as it might have been. But is what Scholz is saying basically correct, that at some point there does need to be some sort of negotiated settlement, but we're unlikely to see that while Russia thinks it still has the upper hand?
Yes, I do think it's correct, but also think, you know, at least my sense is that there is some frustration there in that Scholz did, you know, kind of like talked all those big words, etc. But while Germany is still either refusing to send some weapons or being very, very slow at delivering the weapons it said it would. So, it is all nice and good to say, actually, you know, we are taking a stand here as a continent nearly against Putin, and we'll only go to the negotiating table if he does realise, obviously, as he says, that Putin cannot win, while also not really ensuring that Ukraine can keep fighting and can keep putting its weight.
Because if this crunch comes, James, it's going to be very difficult on a number of fronts. First, there's going to be anybody, even from a position of sympathy and good faith, trying to persuade Ukraine at this point that they should concede anything. Ukraine, I would think, certainly Ukraine's people would not be in any mood to do that, and quite understandably. And then there's going to be the difficulty that even if President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine comes around to seeing that they have to figure out what they can reasonably come to terms on, he's then going to have to sell that back to Ukraine's people. And again, that's not going to be easy either, however much respect they may have acquired for him in the last few months.
He is. And I think the moment at which Vladimir Putin, to borrow Chancellor Schultz's words, realises that he's lost is very, very, very distant from here. And for the idea for some negotiations to take place, I think that also is extremely remote, because remember, part of the reason why the Kremlin launched this invasion, launched this war, is because, in effect, they don't accept that Ukraine exists. And how, therefore, can Putin possibly sit down at a table with Zelensky, the president of a country which doesn't exist? So I think we're a very, very long way off. And while some commentators have suggested that Ukraine might be well advised to just say, OK, well, we're not going to win this, we'll let this bit of the country go, that would be very, very hard to sell politically after the huge sacrifice and huge loss of civilian and military life that has come in the last few weeks.
But also, I'm sure the worry would be, if that were to happen, and, if Ukraine were to be extremely pragmatic and say, we'll let go of part of our territory, what is to stop Russia from trying again in about 5 years if they realise that clearly the way to get more territory is to fight a war until the point when Ukraine sort of gives up? What is there to stop? It's not even guaranteed, in my eyes at least, that that would be the end of that forever and ever.
I think Zelensky has attempted to remind European powers that their previous experiences of attempting to appease acquisitive tyrants have not worked out tremendously well in the long run.
He does have a point, I believe.
Yeah, he does. Do we get a sense, though, just to follow that up, Mari, that Russia is going to start to see the advantage of a faltering amount of European resolve / interest in what is happening in Ukraine? I mean, we have seen the visits to Ukraine by European leaders are continuing. Sanna Marin, Finland's prime minister, was visiting Kyiv today. But the trouble that Ukraine are going to find themselves facing, isn't it, that It's diminishing returns. They need to find a way to keep this on the front pages, to keep this in everybody's minds. Ludicrous, though, it obviously is that news organisations and publics are kind of zoning out of a major land war in Europe. That is what's happening.
It is, and I think it's not. I mean, it's both unfair and it isn't, right? Because, there is, for example, in Britain, 9% inflation at the moment. There's a massive cost of living crisis, which is happening to different extents over the European continent. So there are other issues, which obviously, ironically, are partially caused by the war and partially not, which means that actually, in terms of like national leaders and also national press in general, does have to start focusing, I think, on more domestic issues at the detriment, obviously, of the Ukraine war.
Just a final thought on this one for the moment, James. Russia being very much your specialty and your former beat, do you get any sense at all that Russian resolve is wavering? I mean, certainly since this thing started, there's been a lot of, fond imagining, I think, on the part of a lot of people that Russian, rank and file might mutiny, that Russian officers would start squabbling amongst themselves, that somebody might inform, President Vladimir Putin that they were grateful for his service, but his time was now up.
If that moment comes, I think it's still quite a long way in the future. I don't see it happening at all at the moment. I mean, I think Schultz's words are quite interesting in the remarks he said today. Just to return to those briefly, he said, a capture of the whole of Ukraine seems further away now than at the beginning of the war. And I think that now is very, very interesting because, yes, it is further away than it is at the beginning of the war. It doesn't mean to say that it's not going to happen again in a couple of years' time, as Marie was suggesting. So I think, Russia is in this for the long term. There's nothing to suggest that, public opinion is turning against the Kremlin on the kind of scale that would lead to any sort of domestic political upheaval. I don't foresee that happening in the coming months.
James and Murray, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you shortly. But now, yesterday, the International Atomic Energy Agency's Director General, Rafael Mariano Grossi, revealed that negotiations to revive the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran are at a particularly difficult juncture, as he put it, in a panel discussion at the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos. Monocle's Charlie Fulmer-Court spoke with Grossi after his comments to find out more about where those difficulties currently lie and whether there is any possibility of progress in the near future.
Well, the issue there is that we have been trying to engage Iran in a discussion in order for them to clarify certain things. Basically, it's the fact that the agency discovered traces of enriched uranium, uranium that has been processed industrially or chemically in some way, in places that had never been declared as nuclear facilities or where there is nothing now. So places that may have been razed or sanitized or whatever. So we went, as we do as part of our work in non-proliferation, we approached them, we said, well, we have this evidence. Could you tell us why do we find particles at a place where no nuclear activity in principle should have taken place? So this is maybe put very simple, but this is the there's no mystery. This is the thing. And so far, and this process has lasted for almost 2 years now, so far we haven't been able to get from Iran technically credible explanations. We got some explanations, and it's like an interaction. And when we probe these explanations, they don't make technical sense. So we go back to them, etc. So this is where we are. This is why I say it's been complex. In a few days, I will have to report my findings to the Board of Governors of the IAEA, and then member states will have to make a judgment.
It is a difficult moment at this current point. It hasn't been the most positive news over the last couple of years overall, really. It's been quite a frustrating time, I can imagine, for you and for the organisation. Where do you think we can see some change?
I think this is not going to be an easy situation. I can understand that for Iran, this is seen as an issue that has very deep national security implications. We, of course, don't have an opinion on that, but Iran has also commitments. Iran is a party to the non-proliferation treaty, so they have obligations. It's not out of goodwill, unless they want to cut their links with the international legal system, which would, like North Korea did at some point. So I don't see Iran in that trajectory. I see an Iran that wants to, this is what they tell me, that they want to integrate fully into the world economy, into many things. They see, and it's a very important country, regionally speaking. So what we explain is that without this credibility, without this trust, it's going to be difficult for them. So we see our process as a constructive. Could be uncomfortable at times for them, but there is no way around it. They have to explain, and they have to provide us with a credible explanations that we are in a rightful place to expect from them.
That was Rafael Mariano Grossi, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, speaking to Monocle's Charlie Fulmer-Court at Davos. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24, and here in the UK, for what feels like the dozenth time in his short yet annoying time in Downing Street, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is not resigning. Yesterday's release of a not undamning report revealing prodigious lockdown-era wassailing at number 10 saw renewed suggestions that Johnson should do the decent thing, followed by renewed recollection that the doing of the decent thing has not been one of the more prominent motifs of Johnson's time in public life. The question we wanted to get into here, Mari, is not so much whether, you know, Boris Johnson is just not to be trusted. I think the jury is in on that one. It's the point at which Does they get to a stage at which this starts to become actually properly corrosive? Because I think over a democracy's long history, you're going to get the occasional dud or crooked or inept government. But, and I think people can deal with that. It's just like, okay, this will be weird for a bit and then it'll all be fine. But does there come a point at which it does start to eat into the system beyond that?
So I'm, and this may well be me choosing to be optimistic, but I'm not convinced, because I think there's a big difference here between someone breaking the rules again and again and being very popular as a result. So, i.e., for example, you know, Donald Trump to an extent, although he obviously lost the election, and someone doing it and actually doing appallingly in the polls, which is what Boris Johnson is currently doing. So I'm not sure it's currently working. You know, obviously he is still being held in place effectively by Conservative members of Parliament who feel there is no plan B at the moment still somehow. But, you know, he's not being kept there by people kind of going up, you know, all hell are Brexit king. So in that respect, I'm personally not especially worried, but I may be wrong. I'm just quite an optimistic person by nature.
But just to follow that up, though, as not merely an optimistic person, but as somebody who chronicles the political circus for a living, how unusual is it and how disruptive is it? Because this is what strikes me as, well, interesting is possibly the wrong word, but distinctive about Johnson and certainly about Donald Trump and actually about very few other politicians I can think of, probably only really Silvio Berlusconi to the same extent. Absolute, total ironclad shamelessness, as in just simply not caring about anything. It's kind of a superpower.
It really is. And I think the problem as well is that he makes people around him worse as well, which we've seen, I think, for several years now. And I was quite struck. So I was talking to a Conservative MP recently who's still technically supportive of Boris Johnson. And I asked him point blank at someone, I was like, you know, does it not get tiring just going on the radio, going on television, having to defend something that, you know, as someone who's not entirely stupid, that, you know, should be the indefensible? And actually, I was quite struck because he said, you know what? It was at the beginning, but I'm just quite used to it now. It's genuinely fine. So I think that's the problem. He demeans everyone around him on the long run.
Well, that does prompt a certain amount of wonderment, James, about whether we have reached the end or the natural end of what Peter Hennessy, I think it was, once described as the good chap theory of British government. And this is the theory that basically holds that in a country with no written constitution, where everything is done on precedent and convention and a certain amount of fudge, arguably even hypocrisy, but what it all hinges on is an understanding that we are all good chaps, that, you know, people will basically do the right thing most of the time. It's not really good enough when someone like Boris Johnson bowls up, is it?
No, it's not. I was actually invoking the good chap theory over the breakfast table yesterday morning as I was listening to one of those excruciating interviews where someone's, you know, to borrow cricketing or baseball parlance, sent into bat, you know, and you think, you know, well, what do they get out of it? I mean, maybe, Marie, I'm a wee bit more cynical. I think they're probably thinking, if I do enough of these, I'll get a place in the House of Lords eventually. You know, this will be my reward. But I think it doesn't work, you know, and Lord Hennessy has pointed out, you know, that exactly that sort of time in British politics has possibly run its course. It's going to be very interesting to see if that is the case or if it is, as you suggested in your introduction to this item, Andrew, that, you know, you're bound to have a few dud governments. But, I mean, I was actually, my breath was taken away yesterday when Johnson was saying in the House of Commons, you know, I take full responsibility for it. Yes, and that's it. He just says he takes full responsibility and nothing, and does nothing in consequence except say, you know, we better get on with it.
And also, he is, of course, a man with absolutely no record of ever having taken the remotest amount of responsibility for literally anything in his entire life. Murray, I wanted to go back to that point you were making about the fact that he is polling quite badly. Is there grounds for optimism there? Because the conventional wisdom when he got elected was that the voters know all this stuff about him and they don't care. So was that wrong, or has his behaviour in government been sufficiently egregious that the people who didn't care then do care now?
So I think what's changed, I think there was perhaps an element of, oh, you know, Boris the cad, but actually he will grow up when he gets into government. I wonder if there's, you know, maybe a part of that. But I think it's also that we, you know, like we'd come out, so you had to remember that Boris, the 2019 election happened after many years of, you know, dour, boring, insufferable fights about Brexit. And I think Boris, the funny man, kind of coming in and be like, oh no, jolly good, we'll just get Brexit done and then, you know, we'll move on to other things, you know, sunlit uplands, etc. That worked quite well. We then had a global pandemic for 2 years. These are fundamentally serious times that I think call for serious leadership. And I think that's why it looks quite jarring still. And I would guess even to former supporters that we have someone, you know, the clown, the jester, Boris Johnson, in number 10, behaving in exactly the way that he does. But again, in what's calling for serious times, especially, you know, cost of living crisis at the moment as well. People, many, many people could not afford to live either really entirely or in the way they once did. So, it looks very odd, I think, to have all of that as a backdrop and then have the jolly good fun, jolly good chaps of, you know, quite fun cad Boris Johnson governing the country.
So, James, is it therefore weird that the Conservative Party, which has a formidable record of ruthlessness in dispensing with leaders who it believes are surplus to their current requirements, has not shown any real inclination to do that where Boris Johnson is concerned? Or is it just that they understand that they don't really... for all that, as Murray points out, we are living in serious times which call for a serious person, does the Tory party basically understand that at some level it doesn't really have any?
I think that's possibly true. I mean, my personal analysis would be that, you know, there's been something of a purge of the Conservative Party in the last few years, and nobody who didn't support the, you know, the harshest form of the UK's exit from the European Union has been elevated to a high position anymore. Those people, if they are in the party at all, they're barely in the parliamentary party, and they're certainly not in the cabinet. So I think it is surprising. I mean, I think we've got 2 years to go until the election, almost certainly. I noticed that discussion that's happened in the last few weeks about the possibility being a general election this year in this country, the Prime Minister can, or the government can call one when they see fit, has gone away, because I think the Conservative Party has probably decided that's a bad idea at the moment. And I think, you know, if things were different, if we were in the sunlit uplands without, you know, the pandemic and the war, then it might be that people might have forgotten about this in a couple of years' time. But there's very little to say. And if we look at the way the energy bills are rising, 9% inflation and so on, very little to say that things are going to look better in a couple of years' time. And therefore, I think these episodes may come back as an additional factor that will not look good for the government. We can argue or otherwise about whether the state of the economy is their fault, but incumbent governments tend to get blamed for that anyway.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. It's time now for our letter from New York City. And this week, Henry Rhys Sheridan looks at the challenges New York faces when it comes to gun control.
Good evening, fellow Americans. I had hoped when I became president, I would not have to do this again. Another massacre. Uvalde, Texas. An elementary school.
Once again, the US is reckoning with a wave of high-profile shootings. The attack at a Texas elementary school on Tuesday has been the most deadly this year, killing 19 children and 2 adults. In the wake of the tragedy, Texas's relaxed gun laws have understandably been in focus. But gun violence in America isn't limited to jurisdictions that are soft on gun control.
Dozens of community activists, city officials, and people who've been impacted by gun violence walk the streets in Brooklyn today. They want to honor the lives lost, and they also demanded action from Mayor Adams and Governor Hochul. CBS 2's Astrid Martinez has more on the call to end this surge in gun crimes.
United in grief.
I've lost many friends in these very streets.
Demonstrators from all backgrounds, ages, and areas of New York City flooded the streets of Brooklyn. They are just some of the hundreds of New Yorkers impacted by the upward spiral of gun violence in 2022. According to the latest NYPD crime data numbers, there have been more than 445 murders in the city of New York this year. 157 of those shootings have been in the Bronx.
New York City has some of the toughest restrictions on firearm ownership and use in the country. But this hasn't stopped gun crime dramatically increasing in the city since the start of the pandemic. 2 recent shootings on the subway have made headlines, but most gun crimes in New York happen on the city's streets and don't make the news. A vast majority of these crimes are committed with weapons obtained illegally. And most of these weapons originate outside of New York State. So how are these guns getting in? Usually they're transported by car via the so-called Iron Pipeline. The Iron Pipeline is a highway route used to smuggle weapons from 10 states, mostly in the south of the US, to states in the mid-Atlantic and New England.
Traffickers keep the guns coming. We must stop the flow of illegal guns in our city. The iron pipeline must be broken.
Because there are few checks on cars traveling across state lines, it's very difficult to stop this flow of weapons from states where they can be legally purchased and carried to those with stricter gun laws. A second way New Yorkers acquire illegal weapons is through so-called ghost gun kits. These are weapons assembled from parts ordered online. Because ghost gun kits are not classified as firearms, people can buy them without undergoing any background checks or acquiring a permit. It also means the finished product doesn't have a serial number, meaning it can't be traced by law enforcement. Both New York State and New York City governments are mobilizing to combat these sources of guns. In January, New York Governor Kathy Hochul led the first meeting of the Interstate Task Force on Illegal Guns.
The phenomenon going on here that we're going to study and understand why this is the case, that as we enter 2022, we are seeing a dramatic increase in the number of guns finding their ways through our borders and into the hands of criminals.
This is a coalition of officials from 9 northeastern states, as well as the federal government. They're working together to stop the illegal trafficking of weapons via the iron pipeline. And New York Mayor Eric Adams has released a blueprint to end gun violence. The plan lays out his administration's multifaceted approach to combating gun crime in the city. It includes a vague promise to mobilize the Federal Department of Justice to crack down on ghost guns. But the fact is, both the iron pipeline and ghost guns will remain outside of local government control. Any effective change has to happen at a federal level. And if history has taught us anything, it's to expect very little when it comes to the federal government taking action on gun control.
Henry Ree Sheridan in New York City. Murray, as we have noticed in the last few days since the shooting in Uvalde, the refrains are all very familiar at this point. And to be honest, the only reason that this particular massacre has attracted the attention it has is just the unusual numbers and depressingly unusual youth of the victims. But this is... usually, mercifully, to a lesser extent than this, it's a daily occurrence in the United States, literally.
Oh, yes, it absolutely is. And I feel like, you know, I've done many media appearances like this over the past 7-8 years where we've talked about exactly the same thing in the same words and saying, you know, we sitting in Europe do not even have the words to talk about this because we fundamentally do not understand it. And I will say exactly the same again. I have no idea what to say if I'm being entirely honest.
It is very difficult, James, especially when we see that by grotesque happenstance, the National Rifle Association is having its convention in Houston this weekend. And Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, former President Donald Trump are all going to go ahead with the speaking engagements they had agreed to, which seems not merely insensitive, but actually in the context almost malicious.
Yeah, well, of course, the National Rifle Association are a famously powerful lobby in the United States politics, you know, and the conventional wisdom has it that you really, really offend them absolutely at your peril. So for them to, this is such a divisive issue, for them to withdraw or to decline their invitations to speak there would be seen as, you know, presumably crossing a fairly major line. I mean, personally, I, you know, somebody spends quite a lot of their professional life teaching people who are going to become journalists and teaching young journalists. Whenever these things happen, I think about how this should be covered. And I share Marie's despair about this. I think, you know, the only way really you can report these stories is to say to pay due respect to the victims and describe, you know, the circumstance in which they died. But, you know, and then the standard thing in covering any story like this is have a big, big discussion about it. But it seems barely worth it on these occasions. The United States has, in effect, decided that this is a price worth paying for gun ownership in the same way that most modern countries have decided we will have trucks, we'll have cars, and they kill people. But actually, because we need them to move stuff around and to move people around, we're going to live with the deaths on the roads. The United States seems to me to have taken a similar decision about gun ownership. It is absolutely beyond me. You know, gun ownership, I think, is above 100% in the United States. In other words, there's plenty of people who've got more than one weapon. And it is, it's just, you know, it's part of their foundation myth. And so, no, I'm not surprised that they haven't withdrawn. And you wouldn't, might, and then we, I'm sure we'll hear that old trite line that guns don't kill people, people do, several times this weekend. But the United States doesn't seem to have an answer to this.
I mean, is there anything, Mari, to be said for an even more robust approach to how this thing does get covered by media? As James points out, we have seen all the standard stuff coming out of Uvalde, and it is all absolutely horrendous. You know, the pictures of these sort of happy, cheerful young kids and their teachers who had, you know, no reason to expect that anything like, well, should have had no reason to expect that anything like that might happen. But does the media need to get a bit more in the faces of the legislators who allow this to happen? We did see at least one British journalist try this with Ted Cruz today, and Ted Cruz being Ted Cruz bolted for the nearest available exit. But does it's one of those things, though, isn't it? I guess I'm already answering the question that the people who watch that are going to see what they want to see. The people who sympathise with Ted Cruz will have seen him being hectored by some fancy pants European journalist who's probably a communist.
Well, yes, but I don't really know where I stand on this either. I do think there's a point to be made about money in politics, because actually, if you look at Ted Cruz, for example, you know, has got, I believe, you know, now has received donations of several million dollars over the years from the National Rifle Association. Many other politicians, you know, the ones who are saying thoughts and prayers, are also people who have received tremendous amounts of money from the gun lobby. So, you know, is that an angle that should be explored even more? But then, and obviously, you know, that's probably because of the press I read. I'm aware of those links. So clearly the press is talking about them. So, yeah, I'm not really sure what more the media can be doing, if I'm entirely honest. I just don't really know. Obviously, I like the idea that there's something more we could be doing as a trade. I just don't have the answer for what that is.
Well, finally on today's show, and to change gears entirely, we look at the latest heroic attempt by certain citizens of one of the world's richest, safest, freest, and most generally agreeable countries to persuade themselves or anyone else that they are the miserably oppressed subjects of a brutal tyranny. Quebec's provincial government has made another dogged wriggle against the iron grip of Ottawa, passing new laws protecting, if not downright enshrining, the French language in Quebec, limiting the use of English in the legal system, capping enrollment at English language schools, and in a fun, nakedly xenophobic touch, making access to services for immigrants and refugees conditional on learning to speak French within 6 months of arrival. Mari, regular listeners to these programs will be aware that I have a certain prejudice that I bring to bear here, which is that I think that Quebecois nationalism is possibly the most ridiculous cause on God's green earth. Does the French language need protection? I mean, anywhere, really. It seems to be doing all right for itself on a global level, but in Quebec in particular.
It's doing fine, and I think, and I'm not sure if Quebecois people realise that we in France make fun of them quite a lot. So, you know, the whole...
Could you do it a bit more?
I mean, it was the whole thing of, like, so obviously, in France, we will use English words occasionally, you know, not the full franglais necessarily, but, you know, we'll talk about le shopping, for example. Whereas, you know, in Quebec, they're like, no, le magasinage. So for every word we use in French, that we've just borrowed from English, because that's how languages work. They'll be like, no, we have invented, we are more French than you. We have invented a word for this. And we're like, okay, that's a bit odd, but sure, you know, you go ahead. So yeah, I'm with you here.
And listeners, Mari says that with the authority, not merely of somebody French who speaks French, but somebody who is literally wearing a hooped shirt right now. So, you know, she totally knows what she's talking about. James, does any... it strikes me that if you feel like a language needs to be protected, at the risk of sounding like some ruthless cultural Darwinist, that's kind of on the language, isn't it? I mean, a language should be able to stand up for itself, and a language stands up for itself by adapting and by incorporating other phrases and other expressions.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the French words that we've got in English, you know, and as French friends are often quick to remind me, you know, we haven't got a word for restaurant in English, you know, which they suggest is some kind of reflection on our cuisine. But I love learning languages. It's one of the great pleasures of my life, and I'm just starting to learn a new one, actually. And so I regret when languages are dragged into politics like this, but someone as cynical as me does understand that's a hopelessly idealistic point of view. But you're right, you know, sadly, languages do disappear, and I think that is a matter for regret. But once you get to that stage where you have to legislate to protect them, it does work in some ways, and I think the way probably to protect them is to protect them within the education system and in public life to an extent, but not necessarily to the exclusion of just, you know, banning other words. It doesn't tend to work. People will, you know, more people will be encouraged to learn it, but I don't like to see language used as a political weapon, as it seems to be in this case.
Well, and as we were saying, you don't need to protect French. It's fine. Loads of people speak it. And Murray, is this just basically the Quebecois iteration of the paranoid culture war nonsense that we see, you know, conjured over other issues elsewhere?
I mean, yeah, I mean, my theory would be, which is equally unkind, which is that people probably just got really bored during the pandemic and just kind of had to find something to do, some new cause to fight for. And we're like, yeah, fine, we'll pick that up, you know, like 6 months or 2 years or whatever in lockdown, we'll do that to you.
And just a final thought on this, James, is it reasonable to detect a certain dog whistle in the whole bit about immigrants and refugees have to learn within 6 months which items of garden furniture are feminine and masculine, which ones aren't?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it doesn't quite go to that level. I mean, I've been learning French for many years, but it's a bit rusty because, like a lot of people, despite my boast at the beginning, I haven't actually travelled very much recently and not had huge occasion to practice it.
James Rogers and Marie Leconte, thank you very much both for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists, Marie Leconte and James Rogers. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Callum McLean. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.